What do you want?
It's not that simple.
What do you want?
Darling, you gotta let me know, should I stay or should I go? Getting pulled between our feelings, higher highs had us dreaming that this run would never end. Even though we can't pretend that rallies run in straight lines, they get broken up like rhymes. Between the beats, on the drops, new floors, new tops, new cups, new handles. Resistance and support, like Brunson and Randall. Like different asset classes breaking out at different times. Like Bitcoin and gold, that's bending my mind. Like why is this precious metal having its moment in the sun? When the economy seems strong, prices rising by the ton. Market dynamics smelling funky. Something smelting, I guess. Let's dig for some answers on the Investopedia Express. Welcome back and welcome aboard, and mind the track changes. The three major U.S. equity indexes closed lower on Friday and for the week after touching record highs on Thursday. A slightly hotter than expected February jobs report and some big selling of some of the biggest stocks interrupted the all-time high parade, with the NASDAQ dropping 1.2% for the week, while the Dow and S&P fell 0.9% and 0.3% respectively. That retreat broke a run for the S&P 500, wherein it has closed higher for 16 out of the past 18 weeks, the best four-month performance in over 50 years. And if you've been watching the market closely over the past few weeks, you'll have noticed that the biggest stocks have been some of the biggest losers lately. Alpha, Alphabet, and Tesla have all hit 52-week lows relative to the S&P 500. NVIDIA, which has become everyone's favorite stock, fell 5.5% on Friday as some traders may have done some profit-taking, and there have been profits to take as shares of that chipmaker are up over 260% in the past year. And while the Magnificent Seven stocks have been fading lately, the rest of the market has been playing a little catch-up. The equal-weighted S&P 500, which is represented through the ETF RSP, hit an all-time high last week. And if you like your stocks in small packages, small caps have also joined the party. Since late last year, both the small-cap Russell 2000, represented by the ETF IWM, and the equal-weighted RSP, they're both up over 20%. For a lot of market watchers, this just confirms a typical pattern of an ongoing bull market. As Elaine Gazzarelli of Gazzarelli Investment puts it, the troops are joining the generals. She expects that over the next 6 to 12 months, small cap companies could really start rolling as the economy continues to advance and interest rates begin to decline. That said, the Russell 2000 is still 15% below its all-time highs. And if you believe the economy is more in mid-cycle recovery as opposed to early cycle, like our pal Liz Young at SoFi, those little stocks may not have a lot left in the tank. And that leads us straight into our big three for the week. Number one, there are plenty of risk pirates out there who don't think this party is even close to over. Bitcoin prices surpassed $70,000 for the first time last week, and traders are piling into bullish call options like it's a Garth Brooks concert. Boots, blood, dust, mud, and the thrill of the ride, and those risk riders are getting paid for it. According to Citi, stocks with the highest volume of call options have been performing better than all others so far this year. That streak may have ended last week, but the bullishness is infectious. Just take a look at the credit markets, especially junk bond yields. Typically, junk bonds, which is credit issued by risky companies, offers pretty high yields because of the risk. But the gap between junk bond yields and investment grade yields has been narrowing week after week. That's a sign that bond traders don't feel a lot of downside risk for these companies or the economy. What are they missing? Number two, the recent sell-off of some of the biggest stocks in the market has brought the S&P 500 price-to-earnings multiple back down to a much more mellow place. In fact, the forward P/E ratio of the 10 biggest stocks in the S&P 500 trades at 25 times forward earnings. It was as high as 36 times earnings in the heyday of 2021 and as high as 43 times forward earnings during the 1999 internet bubble. These companies in 2024 are a lot more profitable than they were in 2021, and a heck of a lot more profitable than the dot-com bubble stocks at the end of the millennium. If you look at the forward P/E ratio of the S&P 500 without the top 10 stocks, it's even cheaper, trading at only 19 times forward earnings. Does that feel like a bubble? And number three, while it may not feel like a bubble, it does feel a little costly, especially if you look at the market through what's known as the Buffett indicator. That's right, an indicator named after the goat. He's earned it. And the Buffett indicator is a valuation metric that compares the market cap of the Wilshire 5000 index to U.S. nominal GDP. The Wilshire 5000 represents the 5000 biggest stocks across U.S. markets, and its market cap is around $51.9 trillion at last count. Meanwhile, nominal GDP, which measures the economic production in the economy, including the current prices of goods sold, sits around $28 trillion as of the fourth quarter of last year. So using this metric, the Buffett indicator has a current level of 1.9, and that shows us that the market is the most expensive it's been since April of 2022, right around the time when the Fed started hiking rates. Remember, the Fed is likely to start cutting rates sometime this summer, but the market has already recovered its 2022 losses and then some, yet rates are still the highest they've been in 23 years. When the Fed starts cutting rates and money gets cheaper, stocks could get a lot more expensive relative to the strength of the economy. Let's get set up for the week ahead, and we'll be on inflation watch again as the Consumer Price Index and the Producer Price Index for the month of February are released this Tuesday and Wednesday. Recent inflation readings like the PCE are telling us that this last leg of inflation remains pretty stubborn as prices are still kind of stuck around that 3% year-over-year range. The Federal Reserve will be in a quiet period ahead of its next meeting on interest rates on March 12th. Again, no changes are expected at that meeting, and Jerome Powell keeps saying that the central bank is data dependent. So let's see what the inflation data looks like this week ahead of that meeting. We'll get U.S. retail sales data on Thursday, and that will tell us if the economy can continue to count on our spending to keep it growing. Remember, 70% of U.S. GDP comes from consumer spending. Retail sales slumped in January, but that may have been a little hangover from the holiday sales shopping binge. We'll also get the latest reading on consumer sentiment, which has been getting better even though our debt levels just keep on rising. First quarter earnings season is wrapping up, and surprise, surprise, it was better than expected. It always is. But with 489 of the 500 companies reporting results so far, 76% of them have beaten estimates by an average of 7.3%. Notably, the estimated year-over-year earnings growth rate improved from 1% to plus 8%. Companies keep finding ways to improve their profit margins because they know that investors will reward them if they do. We'll get results this week from companies including Oracle, Dollar Tree, Kohl's, Adobe, Lennar, and Williams-Sonoma, among others. Gold is having a moment. To be sure, the precious metal has had many moments going all the way back to the Han Dynasty in China 300 years before the Common Era, through the Golden Age of Greece, all the way up through the California Gold Rush and into the modern era. The gold standard, whereby countries tied their currency to the price of gold, has been abandoned for decades. But gold as a store of value has never really gone out of style. It gets brought out of the closet, or vault as it were, in times of economic uncertainty though. There is something about that heavy metal that rings deep into our financial psyches. We can see it, we can wear it, we can hold it, we can trade it, we can dig for it. We want golden tans. It's deeply rooted into the human experience. But as an investable asset class, it doesn't really have the shine of stocks, crypto, and other riskier products, or the returns, especially over the last 20 years. Gold prices are up 53% since 2004, while the S&P 500 is up 173% in that same time frame, and the NASDAQ is up 270%. You get the point. It's a heavy asset, and many, including nearly every central bank on the planet, uses it as an anchor for their economies and their portfolios, especially when the seas get choppy. But with the stock market near record highs and the economy, especially the U.S. economy, appearing to stabilize, why are gold prices at record highs? That doesn't necessarily compute with the way gold prices historically behave. I wanted to dig a little deeper, pun totally intended, into why this might be happening, and I wanted to hear what the gold industry thinks about all of this. So, while in London last week, I paid a little visit to the World Gold Council. It calls itself a membership organization that champions the role gold plays as a strategic asset, and its members are some of the biggest gold mining and metals companies in the world, like Barrick Gold, AngloGold Ashanti, and Eldorado. Make no mistake, the World Gold Council is bullish on gold, and it wants to get the message out to the investing world that the precious metal is not just a historical obsession or the wedding gift of choice in places like India and China. It's a critical element in today's techno-industrial world, and it's also as valuable a store of wealth as it's ever been, especially in uncertain times.
My name is Louise Street, and I'm the Senior Markets Analyst at the research team here in the World Gold Council.
What is the World Gold Council?
Yeah, well, that's a good place to start as any, I suppose. We are a membership organization. We were set up in the late 1980s, and we have a membership of more than 30 of the world's leading gold mining companies. They make up our board. You know, some representatives of some of those member companies make up our board. And really, we're here as a resource to tackle sort of three things. There are three core pillars to what we do. We improve understanding, we improve access to gold, and we improve trust in gold. Now, my role in the research team sort of touches on all of those elements, but really the primary one is around understanding, so increasing understanding around gold. Now, we've done a lot of research that shows that investors, whether kind of individual investors, institutional investors, don't necessarily always have the best understanding of the role that gold can play, primarily as an asset in an investment portfolio. So really, you know, we aim to break down the investment case for gold into kind of its key characteristics, into why it performs so well as a strategic asset, and to break down barriers around that understanding. And in a nutshell, the three factors that we kind of really focus on around gold's investment characteristics are returns, diversification, and liquidity. So to quickly cover each of those, returns, you know, there's this perception that as a non-yielding asset that doesn't have a coupon or a dividend, gold doesn't generate returns. And that's not the case. I mean, if you look at its historical performance, if you look at performance over the last 1, 3, 5, 20 years, it's generated anywhere between, in US dollar terms, 6 and 8% per year. So, you know, not really returns that are going to be sniffed at by any investor. If you look at the longer term history since 1971, when Bretton Woods collapsed, it's around 8% per year. So its proven performance in terms of returns is actually pretty positive. If you take that in conjunction with then its role as a diversification tool, it becomes even more compelling. You know, it's got a very well-documented negative correlation with equities, with risk assets. So it provides that downside protection when equities are falling. You know, if you've got gold in your portfolio, that's going to help to mitigate that. But the most important element of gold's negative correlation is it's asymmetric. So when you see a particularly sharp fall in equities, the negative correlation actually increases. So it's really important at those times that we've seen, you know, the global financial crisis, during the pandemic, where actually gold kind of dials up its risk hedge capabilities. And then not only that, it's not only in times of economic turmoil, but gold can actually then generate positive returns during more positive economic times. So it's kind of switches its correlation to kind of add to portfolio performance during those times as well. And then the last one on that list was liquidity. You know, gold is a really liquid market. A lot of people don't really realize quite how sort of deep the market is. If you look at average trading volumes per day, I think over the last 5 years, it's roughly $140 billion a day. And if we put that in context of other global assets, it's around treble what's traded in the Dow Jones or UK gilts. It's in line with euro sterling or 1 to 3 year treasury. So that depth of market is really important. It means it can absorb large institutional buy and hold investors. It doesn't dry up at times of market stress. And crucially, and what we do see is that it can be that sort of source of liquidity when risk assets are falling or are difficult to sell for some reason. If you're having margin calls, you know, gold can be that crucial source of liquidity.
So what's your take on why gold prices are sort of surging to or around record highs right now? We have record highs in many stock markets around the world. The economies in developed countries are doing okay, but there is some unrest going on. But what's your take?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, obviously at the moment, we've got specific dynamics. I mean, if we take a little bit of a step back, you know, gold over the last 15 months or so has had a really good run. Last year, it was one of the best performing assets globally. It generated 15% return in 2023. We've written quite extensively about that and about what was contributing to that. And a major factor was central banks. You know, they've been buying in record amounts over the last couple of years. And that was really helping to underpin the strength in demand last year. If we sort of focus in on the more recent moves, obviously, you know, we saw that jump up last Friday and it's continued ever since. From conversations with market participants, it seems that was initially sort of a technically driven move. So since 2020, I think, gold has tried and failed on a number of occasions to break through 2070. We saw a weak print in US manufacturing numbers on Friday, and that seemed to really trigger, you know, this continued debate about when the Fed are going to cut rates. You know, it's been an ongoing and very sort of shifting picture around what people are expecting in terms of when and how many cuts are going to happen. But obviously, the weak manufacturing print kind of brought that again to the fore, maybe made people kind of adjust their expectations forward a little bit. And crucially, you know, rates are seen as an opportunity cost for gold. So if rates are going higher, often investors will interpret that as kind of raising the opportunity cost for gold. So when there are expectations that rates are going to be coming down sooner, gold can benefit. So that seemed to trigger this sort of technical break, which apparently was kind of largely driven by commodity trading advisor trading strategies. Once that broke and the move kind of gained momentum, then stops were triggered. You know, there was momentum kind of carrying the move higher, which was a bit of a broader base in the move, which was futures driven. Again, if you look at the volumes of open interest on COMEX, they were kind of rising sharply in conjunction with the rise in price.
When you say that central banks are buying gold, are they literally buying bars of gold and storing them in vaults? Are they buying gold futures? Are they loading into ETFs? I don't see central banks being big GLD buyers. But when you say that, what do you actually mean?
We have a central bank team here at the World Gold Council who are they're very well connected. They've got a lot of very strong relationships with central banks globally. We run a survey, which we've done for the last 5 or 6 years, which delves into reserve asset management strategies, what's driving them, how they're being sort of executed. And yeah, I mean, in short answer is a lot of central banks will be buying physical gold bars and storing them in vaults. There will be an element of ETF buying as well, but fundamentally, you know, gold central bank gold buying will often take place over the in the over-the-counter market. And they'll either be stored kind of centrally in vaults in centres like, you know, London, or they'll be stored domestically.
So this surge in gold prices, it's kind of been bubbling for a while, but definitely in the last few weeks, it's happening at the same time we're seeing record highs again for risk assets in some stock markets, crypto, NFTs. Now, these are very different things. Is this a tale of sort of two investors, sort of retail traders and people not wanting to have anything to do with anything tied to a central bank system out there buying crypto and NFTs? On the other hand, institutions, big investors, central banks buying gold for the stability that it has. What's your perception of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's a range of things that drive gold, and sort of to unpick a few bits of the parts of those questions. Gold and the crypto sort of argument, whether there's one versus the other, that's kind of an age-old argument that's been around ever since cryptos have. And we've done a lot of research that shows that people don't see them as substitutes for one another. So investors who are kind of au fait with both from a retail perspective or sort of, you know, an individual investor perspective or institutional, very much recognize they've got different characteristics. They hold them for very different reasons. And they're actually more likely to hold them both together than they are to sort of rotate from one to the other. So from that point of view, gold and cryptos kind of, you know, aren't competing with one another. Gold has a lot of different drivers. It's part of what makes it such a unique asset is that it's got different uses and different users. So obviously it ranges from being jewelry to being an important part of your iPhone that's sitting there on the table, to being a central bank asset, to being an investment. So it responds differently to these kind of different drivers. So on the one hand, you know, yes, we've got a rise in risk assets, which traditionally you'd expect would not be particularly positive for gold. At the same time, we've got very heightened levels of global geopolitical risk and just general risk and uncertainty. You know, even to the extent of, you know, prospective soft landing or not, you know, it's generating a lot of uncertainty in terms of actually what's on the cards for the global economy, for the global financial markets. And that's traditionally been a very supportive factor for gold. It's a key driver of gold investment, both in terms of actual investment and in terms of a sort of gold as a central reserve asset. So when you take all those things into account, plus the fact that on the, as you say, economic side, you know, we've actually got some pretty healthy economic growth. That's a key driver of consumer demand for gold. So jewelry demand last year, you know, despite the fact that the price was reaching record highs in some markets, you know, continued record highs. India, for example, and China were seeing kind of very, very strong record levels in the gold price. Jewelry demand actually held up pretty well. And that's that kind of wealth effect coming through. So actually, it's sort of, you have these drivers of gold, which can sometimes help offset one another. And kind of, you'll see different elements of the market coming to strength at different times. Last year, we seem to see sort of almost all of them having kind of positive impacts.
Yeah, you rarely see that. So you expect, the Gold Council expects demand and prices to keep rising through this year, mostly due to geopolitical tensions, if I read your report correctly. Is that right?
Well, we can't provide a forecast in the gold price. So given who we are, we can't do that. We do have some really useful models which help to understand how to value gold and what it is that drives it. And it's this interplay, as I've mentioned, between these different elements of demand and the different drivers of elements. So if we unpick what we expect to happen in each one of those, and we can kind of understand how that might drive gold and its performance. So if we look ahead to this year, yes, one of the key things is heightened geopolitical risk and uncertainty. That's not going away. And that is certainly a very key support for both investment demand and central bank demand. I referenced our survey earlier on. What we've consistently seen in the last two, if not three annual surveys, when we ask central banks, you know, why is it that you're holding gold, what's driving that allocation, some of the top answers that they give are that they value its performance in times of crisis, They value its role as a diversifier and as a long-term store of value. So those three factors aren't going away anytime soon behind the central bank.
There are 60-some elections happening around the world, namely
exactly.
the U.S. presidential election, but there's other big elections happening.
Exactly.
That could be a time of uncertainty.
Yeah, 100%. And we, a colleague of mine actually in the research team, Johan Palmberg, he did some work specifically looking at geopolitical risk index. If we add that into our gold return attribution model, which attributes monthly changes in the gold price to different factors, we can isolate the effect that yes, gold geopolitical risk absolutely does has a positive effect on gold. So that's kind of been an underlying factor that's helped support the gold price really in the last primarily 4 years, 3 to 4 years, and will continue to do so this year for exactly the reasons you mentioned, you know, the record-breaking election year, you know, the various different conflicts that are going on, and also the uncertainty, as I mentioned, around what's happening with the path of the US economic recovery. And that's another factor that's really important for this year. It's kind of, when are rates going to come down? Will the soft landing be engineered? Because it's by no means a given. It's been historically, you know, notoriously difficult for the Fed to actually manage that balancing act. I think in the last nine rate hiking cycles, only two of them have managed to end in a soft landing. So you have to consider, okay, so if they don't manage it, what does that mean? Does it mean the US tips over into recession? If it does, we're going to see much sharper and earlier rate cuts. That's really positive for the investment sector for gold. On the contrary, it's not great for consumer demand, because obviously we have a huge economic slowdown, then that's going to impact consumers. And that was that balancing that I was telling you about. You know, you're going to see on the one hand the big rise in investment, and then perhaps on the other side that tension with a drop in jewelry consumption.
Yeah, gold does have that seesaw effect because it has these multiple uses. Let's talk about consumer demand, namely in India and China, right, where I think it's much more popular in terms of jewelry, even though it's super popular around the world. But they are driving the market. How much can that really drive the market in terms of price demand on the consumer front?
Yeah, I mean, it's more in case of it puts a floor in. So you won't really see the price being driven or being set by Chinese and Indian gold jewelry buyers, you know, on a sort of a short-term basis. But over the long term, absolutely, they will help to both establish a floor. And as economic wealth and expansion grows in those countries, then yes, you will see kind of a more gradual impact on the gold price. But they're not, you know, I wouldn't pinpoint them as driving the recent move up to record highs.
So let's talk about it from the industrial side, and certainly from the mining side. And a lot of your members here are miners. It's expensive. It's capital intensive. Long lead times for gold, right? At what price per ounce is it even break even for mining companies? Can you equate it to like oil, where it's $50 a barrel and that's gravy? Or is there no set sort of price that you look at?
Yeah, it's not that simple. There's obviously a curve, which will depend. It could be mine specific in terms of what that looks like. But I mean, obviously, you know, mining, gold mines in particular, have quite a long lead time in order to set them up. You know, it can take 10 years before a mine sort of even comes on stream. I mean, the outlook for mine production is pretty positive. It's proved itself to be very resilient actually over the pandemic. Took a bit of a hit in 2020, but it recovered very quickly. And we've seen gold mine production. We thought we were going to see a record last year. We stopped just shy of the 2018 record. There were a few kind of disruptions that we hadn't bargained on. But if we look at sort of the glide path going forward, the prospects for gold mine production are pretty positive.
A lot of investors, retail investors, but also institutional investors, access gold through ETFs. There's GLD, you guys are a part of that in some way, right? There's the gold miner ETFs, if you want to invest in the picks and the shovels. These are kind of derivative products. So for those investors out there that are buying those ETFs, what do they actually own when they buy them?
It's sort of product dependent, but certainly from the perspective of the gold mining, or sort of the gold-backed ETFs that we publish. So we publish the most comprehensive data set out there on inflows and outflows into these products globally. The ones that we monitor will always be at least 90% backed by physical gold. So it does essentially represent an investment in a physical bar of gold, or a partial bar. There are certainly products out there where there will be other kind of lower allocations or sort of a lower backing of gold. And we don't include those in our database because we obviously want to sort of physically represent what's happening in gold.
So when you say physical gold, are you saying that it's being moved from one place to the other, or it's just the ownership, notional ownership of it is just being allocated to the creation redemption of ETFs when they happen.
Yeah, exactly that. And I've been to the vaults to see some of the physical gold bars sitting there. So it's pretty interesting when you.
That is interesting. I'm sure you've heard this before, but Warren Buffett has decried gold for years. 1998, he said, it gets dug out of the ground in Africa. Then we melt it down, dig another hole, bury it, and pay people to stand around and guard it. It has no utility, which I think you disagree with. Anyone watching from Mars would be scratching their head. What do you say to that?
I'd say anyone watching from Mars got there with some very important pieces of gold in the equipment that let them get there. So I would definitely challenge that.
Touche. Is there a limit to supply? I mean, it seems like we could just continue to mine gold until we can't find it anymore. What is the World Gold Council's idea of kind of what's available out there? I know we do this with oil and we talk about peak oil all the time. What about gold?
Yeah, well, there's two aspects, I guess, to gold supply. Obviously, there is what is in the ground, and gold mining companies will be doing a lot of work to look at those resources that are still yet to be mined. There's the gold that we know is in the pipeline currently being mined, and there's what's above ground. So there's around, I'm not up to date with the very latest statistics, somewhere in the region of 210,000 tons of gold above ground that's already been mined over the course of history. So when you consider that mine supply adds around 3,600 tons to that each year. There's already kind of a big stock of gold above ground that also kind of can help contribute to that. It's a key part of helping the gold market to function smoothly all the time is recycling. And particularly in markets like India and China, where gold jewelry is treated much more as a sort of investment as well, that gold recycling forms a key part that enables that market to kind of move so fluidly. Where people will actually, recycle their high carat jewelry. They'll get it exchanged, they'll get it remade into another piece, they'll sell it back, and then it'll be sort of melted down and remade, whether that's into bars or into more jewelry.
Let's touch on some of the industrial uses. I don't think a lot of people understand just how widely used. You mentioned my iPhone. It's definitely in that. It's in probably my dentist's office and various tools. But on the large scale industrial front, give us some examples of heavy uses of gold for those purposes where it's an absolute essential metal.
Yeah, it's funny. It's the smallest element of gold demand. So technology only accounts for around 7% of annual gold demand. But to me, it's the most interesting, or one of the most interesting, because it touches absolutely all of our daily lives without us even thinking about it. And as you mentioned, it's in those applications where, because it's so reliable, it has such a high melting point, it doesn't corrode. It's where you need absolute reliability in the performance of what you're putting it into. Gold is a must-have. We saw sort of between 2008 to 2013, when the gold price was really rising, we saw quite a lot of substitution in bonding wire towards copper. But that was very much in the applications where the manufacturers don't really mind if it fails or it's not kind of safety critical. If you're talking about things like safety sensors, parking sensors in cars, if you're talking about things like facial recognition in phones, if you're talking about low Earth orbit satellites, those are all things where gold will be an absolute essential component because they need to know that it's not going to fail. So yes, while it's not going to move the needle in terms of annual global gold demand, there are elements of gold in that space that are very important. AI, the growth of AI is quite crucial there as well. So the development of the infrastructure needed to help AI develop, gold is an important part of that. And it will be quite intense uses relative to, for example, your iPhone, which will have a microscopic amount of gold. But those AI servers, for example, that are needed to put that infrastructure in place. It was something actually going back to pandemic times, the technology angle of gold demand actually didn't suffer too badly. And it was because we saw that huge migration to working from home. So suddenly everybody needed laptops at home. There were servers that were needed to kind of put that or allow that migration to happen. So the technology demand for gold during that time was actually pretty robust.
Fascinating. All right. There's a lot of stigma around gold mining and the environmental impact, sustainability. We've all heard about it. I think for younger investors, some of them may think of it as sort of a dirty process, so to speak. You guys here at the World Gold Council have done a lot of work with your members on that. What do investors need to know and what do consumers need to know about how it's being mined today? Is it any safer than it was? If so, why?
Yeah, so we have a dedicated ESG team here at the World Gold Council, and they've done some really great research into initiatives around this space. So there's obviously the three different angles to consider when we talk about ESG. I mean, ultimately, our view as an organization is that when it's mined responsibly, you know, gold can make a very positive contribution to socioeconomic development and in fact, also to the carbon footprint of a portfolio. It can be used as a climate mitigation tool when it's added to a balanced portfolio. If you consider 90% of gold's greenhouse gas emissions occur at the point of mining, once you've got it out of the ground, it's very, very few downstream emissions. So it can actually help to reduce the carbon footprint of a portfolio if you have an allocation to gold. It's on a pathway to net zero by 2050. That's primarily due to use of renewable energy at mine sites. So for example, there's a mine that's installed, moved to solar panels, solar energy, and it's saved something like 6 million litres of diesel a year. So it's those steps that are being taken to really help the transition to net zero. We've got the socioeconomic contribution of gold mining, which is a really important thing to consider. Globally, in fact, if you just look at World Gold Council members, they employ 350,000 people. That's the direct employment impact. If you then consider that each of those jobs will support maybe 6 to 10 jobs indirectly down the supply chain, you know, the impact of that is huge. I think if you put it in dollar terms, we directly contributed about $6 billion to host mining countries in 2022. So, you know, the impact and the positive contribution that gold mining can make to those host communities and host mining countries is really, really significant. And then we've got the G, the governance space. So yeah, there's been a lot of initiatives that we've been involved in on this front. In 2019, we introduced the Responsible Gold Mining Principles, which is a framework which sets out what constitutes gold, responsible gold mining. It's mandatory for our members, and we're obviously working with the global industry to try and encourage its adoption among non-member companies as well.
And you got a documentary out there with Idris Elba talking about this entire industry and the entire ecosystem. Wouldn't expect the World Gold Council to put out some documentaries, but it's not your first. Why do that?
It was really driven by the need to, again, it's sort of partly educate people as to the transformational nature of gold. You know, like we've been talking about, there's a lot of lack of understanding or just lack of awareness, I suppose, about quite how crucial the role that gold can play is, and not just as an investment asset. In these technological developments, in nanotechnology, in COVID tests, you know, in malaria tests, gold is really, really important part of those things. So we felt it was important to, you know, put the message out there that gold can play this very transformational, positive role, not only in the sort of the technology space, but in the socioeconomic space as well, which is what the Idris Elba kind of documentary focuses on.
I would love to know your favorite term as it relates to gold. What's the, as from an investor's perspective? So what is Louise Street's favorite gold investing term?
Yeah, it's not really a terminology. So, for example, in markets like Vietnam, they have their own weight categorizations of gold demand. So a bar will be a tile, for example, rather than the ounces and the tons that we're used to here. But they also have gold ring. They've kind of got round regulation around the gold investment space by making these gold rings, which are essentially a gold coin, but you wear it because it's then not classified as gold investment. And they're chi rings. So if you go to Vietnam and buy a chi ring, you're buying an investment, but you've got a piece of jewelry. But yeah, that's kind of one of my favorite terms.
Great to know. We're going to actually link to a picture of that in the show notes as well. Louise Street from the World Gold Council, thanks so much for joining the Express.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's terminology time. Time for us to smarten up with the investing and finance term we need to know this week. And given the release of the February jobs report last Friday that was a little stronger than expected with 275,000 jobs added to U.S. payrolls, we're going to stay on the job with the labor leverage ratio as this week's term. According to our favorite website, the labor leverage ratio is a measure developed by economist Aaron Sojourner, a senior researcher at the Upjohn Institute. Sojourner uses the JOLTS data from the Labor Department that tracks job turnovers and separates quits from discharges or firings and layoffs to come up with the labor leverage ratio. When more workers are quitting than getting laid off, it's a sign of strong employee bargaining power. Workers feel confident that they have better options, or maybe they already found a better paying job and they have bargaining power in their current job. Conversely, when more workers are let go than quit voluntarily, it's a sign that companies are cutting staff and workers don't see much opportunity. Well, right now, American workers have the leverage. The labor leverage ratio has fallen from the highs of the Great Resignation in 2021 and 2022 amid the pandemic, but it's still historically high, and it's the highest in industries like leisure and hospitality, healthcare, and retail. So if you're wondering why you're still seeing help-needed signs on restaurants, bars, and malls, it's the labor leverage ratio, and it's still in employees' favor. Thanks so much for riding with us this week, and special thanks to Louise Street from the World Gold Council for climbing aboard the Express and for hosting us at their London offices. We'll link to her team's gold outlook for the year and to the documentary the council produced starring Idris Elba on gold. I'll watch anything that man does. Find all that glitters in the show notes, along with all the reports we cited on this week's episode, wherever you ride the Express, and we'll talk again a little further on down the line.